Big show on Friday, August 30th, winds up the month. Brian Lockhart from the Connecticut Post joins us to talk politics, Bridgeport style, and the run-up to the big Democratic mayoral primary on September 10th. Author and Afghanistan war veteran James Hassan joined us to talk about his new book. He thinks political correctness and social justice warriors are doing serious damage to the U.S. military. In Stratford, GOP State Senator Kevin Kelly joined us for his weekly update from the state capitol.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
Hi there. Sorry it took me a couple of seconds extra to get to you. I had to do some emergency surgery on my phone. I thought it was dead. I thought it had met its maker, but I went to an online quick tutorial here, got the back off, took the battery off, pressed some buttons, and my phone lives. Yes, so we're all good. Thank you. Great way to start the show here, considering that I was not going home after this. And, you know, now in modern society, if you don't have your phone, you start to quiver, you shake, you tear up in your eyes. How am I going to go? No, but we're all good. Okay, deep breath. We're all good. Hey, hi there. It's Connecticut Today. It's a Friday. We made it to the end of the week, and we're at 203-333-9422-333 WICC. Gentleman's going to join us here. He's got a few minutes on a busy Friday to check in and talk all things politics in and around Bridgeport. Our buddy Brian Lockhart from the Connecticut Post. Brian, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Good, good, good. Well, we have the Democratic field now set since the last time that we talked. Marilyn Moore did well and above the number of signatures, Brian, she needed to qualify for the primary against Joe Ghanem, September 10th. I've spoken to both. Both seem optimistic, but of course, that's like spring training. Everybody is 0-0. What are your thoughts on this heading into that September 10th primary?
I spent a little time with both of them this week. I was at a Moore fundraiser on, what day is it now, Friday?
Yeah.
I think on Wednesday. And then I campaigned a little bit with Ghanem last night in the North End. And it was interesting walking around with him because he was greeted, people who were home, he was greeted pretty warmly. I mean, people would come to the door, you know, they were surprised that the mayor was knocking on their door. They were surprised. At one point, he had to walk around to someone's backyard. The guy was doing yard work. People wanted to take some selfies with him. So he got a generally warm reception. But as he would move down the sidewalk to other houses, and I would kind of linger back and talk to these folks a little more, there was a bit of a mixed message. I think it's fair to say people seem to like him. And he's in person, he's a likable guy. But there are some issues. I mean, one couple, the wife said she supports him, and then the husband came to the door to talk to me and said, you know, taxes are too high. I would support more if she would promise to lower taxes. And the wife eventually kind of conceded, yeah, taxes are a problem. Another house, the same thing. They took a photo with the mayor. They were really excited he was there. But afterward, when I was speaking to them, the wife said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to retire in this city, if we're going to be able to retire in this city. It's too expensive here. And then another girl, she was returning home from work, and it was interesting. She lives with her mother.
Yeah.
Her mother took a photo with the mayor. Her mother allowed the mayor to put a lawn sign in their front yard. But the girl afterwards said to me, you know, I really have concerns about education. I know a parent who couldn't send their children to school because they couldn't afford the supplies that the teachers are asking for. So I think, you know, the image I got, or I walked away from last night thinking, okay, this is a guy who is liked.
Yeah.
But he's also a guy who is vulnerable. The flip side of that is the majority of these people who I talked to said they didn't know enough about Marilyn Moore.
Interesting.
Maybe they knew the name, but that was it. They didn't know much about what she had done. They didn't know much about what she stood for. They had tried to search some things online and were unsuccessful.
And maybe, so Brian,
obviously, is a big challenge for her.
Yeah, maybe that's a product too. Once again, you know, yeah, they knew her name, but you know, I always thought that she has one of the more interesting districts because it's carved up, as many people know, between, you know, Bridgeport, Trumbull, and Shelton. So it's not a real completely urban district. She's got big chunks of, you know, upper income suburbia there, which kind of makes her, I would think, not all that familiar to some folks in Bridgeport.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the challenges she has, is to try and introduce herself to these people. I mean, Mayor Ganim has had, you know, when he added all up, he's had, what are we talking now? Let's see, 12, 14, about 16 years, I think, in office total. So he is a well-known quantity.
Yeah.
You know, now at her fundraiser the other night, there were some enthusiastic supporters, and it was interesting. She made a comment, because I guess she has heard people saying, "I don't know you, I've never heard about you," and her quip back is, "Well, you haven't heard anything bad about me, have you? So why not give me a chance?"
I like that. That's pretty good.
but I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know if that is going to be enough.
Yeah.
To you know, lead her to victory on September 10th.
Boy, the power of incumbency, Brian, as you well know, and I've been covering this stuff for 35, 40 years, no matter what you do, it is, I mean, you're illustrating it right now, it is so powerful. I don't care whether you're the president down to dog catcher. I mean, just because somebody is there, you know, Americans on any level can cry and bitch and moan about things, Brian, but we don't, sometimes we just don't like to switch jockeys in the middle of a race.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I mean, he has... The flip side of it is, I think for people, you know, people like you and I who are kind of follow the nitty gritty of it. Okay, so we see, you know, we write about, or we talk about the scandals and we talk about the issues. We this week had a story about a young man who has been working for the city in different jobs.
Saw that, yeah.
Showed up at a crime scene with another cop, and he was fired because that shouldn't have happened. And this is someone who's kind of, you know, I'd say he's kind of a crony in City Hall. You know, he's been around for a couple of years. People seem to like him. But that being said, how many people read that story? How many people care about that story? You know, if someone is happy that their street's paved, or if someone feels their street's safe, or if someone likes a new restaurant, you know, someone liked the new oyster bar on the harbor, or someone went downtown and they saw a great show at the comedy club, that may be just enough for them.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, people are become jaded too, Brian, where they say, yeah, well, you know what, he didn't harm anybody, they fired him. Crony, yeah, show me a city hall or a town hall, you know, that doesn't have that. I know we only have you for a short amount of time. I want to kind of get your closing thoughts on this. You know, when I talked to Marilyn Moore and I talked to Joe Ganim, Marilyn Moore said something interesting. She said one of her goals, she said to me, Brian, was to make the whole idea of setting up a business and getting a foothold in Bridgeport more accessible. She kind of said something to me along the line of, well, you know, you have to be known, you got to know the right people, you got to know the rules. And I mentioned that to Joe Ganim when I had him here in the studio. I said, Mayor, you know, with all due respect, she's kind of intimating this, and he just kind of laughed, and he obviously, as he would likely say, was, you know, that's nothing, that's ridiculous, we're open here in Bridgeport, look at all these new companies interested in the city. So again, there's that divergent look, Brian, that at least on one issue that folks are going to have to, you know, decide on.
Yeah, I do think one of Moore's challenges, though, is, again, I said that the mayor has some vulnerabilities, but she really does need to have some very clear plans and some very solid ideas. You look back 4 years ago, Mayor Ganim was focused during his campaign. It didn't necessarily turn out that way, but he was focused during his campaign on holding the line on taxes.
Mm-hmm.
He was focused on public safety, you know, meat and potatoes type stuff. Marilyn, when I have spoken to her or seen her address a crowd, you do sometimes get a sense that she doesn't have a fully cooked platform.
Okay.
Economic development-wise, you know, I know the mayor has criticized her a little bit because we did a story recently asking her about her economic development plans, and she proposed something called a food hub, which is something that's being built in Waterbury. It's a real thing, but it's sort of a nebulous, it's kind of a nebulous thing. You know, Mayor Ganim kind of jokes it's a glorified farmer's market. It's this nebulous thing, and I don't know if that's something that is, you know, when he has the amphitheater going on, when you do have some businesses downtown, some new restaurants, you do have that oyster bar on the waterfront. I don't know if saying to voters, hey, I will build you a food hub, is really the best pitch. You really need kind of something bigger. You need something better. And the same thing with what you're saying about the permits and things like that. When she says, you know, it's hard to do business, again, that could be true. You hear developers at the least talking about how it is such a slow process to get a permit approved in Bridgeport. The problem is, again, I don't know how much voters, I don't know how much that really resonates with voters.
Yeah, what do they care? Yeah. Brian, thanks, man. We know you're busy. Thanks, Brian Lockhart. Brian, we'll probably check back with you after the Democratic and Republican primaries coming up. Brian Lockhart, folks, you read them all the time in print and online at the Connecticut Post. Brian, have a great weekend. We appreciate it.
You too. Thanks,
Brian. Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye. Yep, there you go. Brian Lockhart there, and keeping an eye on the mayoral race coming up. Of course, the primary is coming up September 10th, and a lot of people would say that, you know, the Democratic primary is kind of the general election by default, but hey, stranger things have happened. You never know.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
For that, we thank you, as always, and we're at 203-333-9422, 203-333-WICC. With you here on Connecticut Today, every Monday through Friday, live local talk for Greater Bridgeport, the Connecticut shoreline, all of Fairfield County. Paul Pacelli here, Aaron Johnson on the other side of the glass. Going to talk about the military right now. And I don't know, is the military the same as it used to be? Now, I did not serve in the military, did not have the honor to do that. I have had several male relatives who have, know some people who are in right now. There's a new book out called Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. Our next guest is a former captain in the U.S. Army, graduating from Army Ranger School. He received the Bronze Star Medal in Afghanistan. He's worked with members of Congress on military issues, appeared on programs all over the country. He went to the University of Virginia Law School, but more importantly, at this time of the year, he did his undergrad at the University of Notre Dame. Go Irish. That's what I always say. James Hassan is the guest. James, Paul here in Bridgeport. Go Irish. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. Go Irish.
Go Irish. To touchdown Jesus has all the answers, I think, James, you know, every so often.
Coming this Monday.
That's right. Hey, a lot of people, James, may see the title of your book and say, and they may say, oh, here's another guy, Social Justice Warriors. Here's just an angry, cranky, right-wing conservative guy who can't handle modern society. I'm sure you've heard that. What's your initial response to that?
Yeah, so my initial response to that is if you read the preface of my book, and, you know, I understand that, you know, the title is provocative, but if you read the preface, you know, what I say is that this isn't about the right politics or the wrong politics when it comes to the military.
Yeah.
And people, you know, we can have kind of the, you know, people have the culture wars, and they can have them. My point is, you know, leave the military out of it and just let it be an institution that is focused on a single mission, which is to protect us all by, you know, preparing to fight and win the nation's wars. And I think General Mattis said it best when he said the military is a conservative institution as a matter of institutional principle, not as, you know, as social conservatism or fiscal conservatism. So that's really the point that I, you know, try and stress in the book, is that, you know, for a number of reasons, the military in the last several years, especially during the previous administration, was used as a, you know, in some ways as a blunt force tool to drive broader social change. And that was, you know, admitted by members of the previous administration.
Sure.
So the military that I joined during President Obama's first term was very, very different than the military I left at the end of his second. And that has significant effects and harmful effects on the military's ability to, you know, fulfill that singular mission. And I think the American people have been, you know, kept in the dark about that, in part because the military is, you know, it's a very small percentage of society.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opaque institution if you're not part of it. And so, but I think, you know, the American people deserve to know. And it's important as we continue now for, you know, 18 years in a row sending people overseas, and people are still fighting and dying overseas, you know, that, that the American people kind of understand what the costs of some of those policies are.
I had a friend, I haven't talked to him in a while, but I had a radio friend, James Hassan, who we used to get into this, talk about this, and as progressive as he was in his politics, he always used to say, look, he goes, he used to say on his show, he goes, folks, you and I being civilians, meaning him and his listeners, we have to understand that the U.S. military is, as you say, James, he didn't use the word opaque. He goes, but it is a different entity. It has mm-hmm. its own justice system, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It has its own culture. It has its own problems, but its own benefits, too. And he was one of the few people I remember saying that it's tough to impose your social mores or things that you might think are, oh, just fine, go ahead with that, on a system that is designed for unit readiness to unfortunately go into battle and have to kill people sometimes.
Right. Right. No, and that's exactly right. And it's, you know, but unfortunately that was not, you know, the approach that a lot of political appointees in the Pentagon and, you know, and throughout President Obama's administration took to the military. So, for example, you know, Valerie Jarrett, who was an assistant to President Obama, a very mm-hmm. close advisor,
yeah.
said, you know, in a speech to the military in 2013, said, well, you know, you have the power to lead social change just as you have before. So we're going to, you know, not just in the military, but throughout society. So we're going to be pursuing, you know, bold initiatives to, you know, going forward. And but that's not, that's not the purpose.
That's anymore. Not the military's so, job.
No. And, you know, so I think, you know, and General Mattis is somebody who has, you know, a former Secretary Mattis is somebody who has broad credibility across, you know, the whole spectrum of American society. And he put it best when he said that you should ask yourself, when you're considering policy changes, you should ask yourself, will this help the military win wars? If the answer is yes, we should do it. But if the answer is no, then we shouldn't. And if the answer is, well, we don't know, then we shouldn't do it because it might hurt their ability to do so. And, you know, so to continue, you know, quoting him, just because, I have a lot of respect for the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I quote him in my preface, and he said basically that, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but that kind of some of these social, you know, justice demands impose harms that will only be evident to some of our political class in the aftermath of military failure.
Yeah, so and James, obviously, James Hassan is the guest. The name of the book, Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. We'll get into some specifics momentarily. But James, do you think that people who want to impose some of these changes that some people think are deleterious, is it only for political purposes to score points with constituents? Or do they honestly really think, some of them, that these changes, the stuff they push through, will actually benefit the military?
You know, and that's a good question, because I don't, you know, I don't judge anyone's you know, good faith, whether their motivations are one or the other. But they might be misguided, but unfortunately, almost all of the, you know, the changes that occurred, you know, 2013, 2014, 15, 16, were opposed, you know, strongly by the members of the Joint Chiefs. And for example, the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
when the you know, the Obama administration said, "Hey, we want you to you know, to create gender-neutral infantry units," which is, you know, 3% of the Marine Corps, the Marines said, "All right, well, give us a year. Let us go ahead and study how this is going to affect us." And what they did is they they went ahead and formed a study out in 29 Palms, California, where they measured for a year the performances of all-male infantry squads versus gender-neutral infantry squads.
Sure.
And they used, you know, outside professionals to crunch all the data, and they had heart rate monitors on everybody. They, every last little, you know, nugget of information was mined.
Mm-hmm.
And they came back and they said to the, to the Obama Department of Defense and the Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, at the time, they said, hey, look, the data shows that, you know, 80% of the time, the all-male units are outperforming the, you know, gender-neutral units.
Sure.
And more specifically, they pointed to examples such as, you know, the gender-neutral infantry units took, you know, up to 178% longer
mm-hmm.
to evacuate a casualty from a vehicle.
Yeah.
But and you think about it, if that vehicle is on fire, when, you know, when seconds count,
lives count. James, you were telling us before the break about incidents before the break where, you know, the military had quantifiable data. For example, you said on the performance of integrated units versus all-male units. You know, I don't think, James, it takes a military expert or an Einstein. With all due respect to women, and we know that there are fabulous women pilots, fighter pilots, helicopter pilots, ship commanders in the Navy. But, James, when it comes down to physical strength on the battlefield and the ability to get to a certain point from A and B, or as you say, to evacuate people in a tough situation or hand-to-hand combat, this isn't rocket science here.
No, it really isn't. And, you know, more to your point, you know, it was always, the discussion was always framed and is still framed as, you know, quote, women in combat. But that was never, it was, an Orwellian phrasing almost because, you know, nobody thinks that, you know, women are constitutionally incapable of, you know, performing in combat. Like you said, there are women that fly Apache helicopters and kill jihadis with 50-millimeter guns that are linked to their helmets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but when you, you know, when you get down to that specific, 3% of the Marines or the Army that are the ground infantry units that put 100 pounds of equipment on and walk for 12 miles, those physical differences come into play. And one of the ways that they do that, that the Marine Corps study also showed that the Obama administration ignored, is that injury rates to the females in the study were, you know, astronomically higher. And the Marines said, hey, you're going to deprive us of our best female Marines because, you know, they're not going to be able to complete, a good percentage of them will not be able to complete full 20-year careers because things like pelvic stress fractures are, you know, 400%, you know, normal rate.
And that doesn't make, you know, James, it doesn't make anyone sexist, I don't think, for pointing out something that is a physiological fact, an anthropological fact. It just doesn't.
Right. No, it's true. And so going back to that, you know, that Marine Corps study, but so they were overruled, right, by the Obama administration.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason that they pointed to that was they said, well, there were, you know, two women who graduated from Army Ranger School. So that is, you know, evidence enough. And at the time, after that, you know, graduation, after those first two female graduates passed, there were a number of whistleblowers who came to a member of House Armed Services named Steve Russell. And he was a former graduate of Army Ranger School himself.
Mm-hmm.
He commanded the battalion that captured, you know, helped capture Saddam Hussein. And they said, hey, listen, the standards weren't upheld here. We were under massive pressure to pass these candidates. And, you know, so Russell took that to the Obama DOD, and Secretary John McHugh, Secretary of the Army, just refused to meet with him for months. And then eventually told him that the documents, the training records that he requested, had been shredded and weren't available. But I was able to obtain copies of those records, some of them, and I published some of them in my book. And they show that, you know, those whistleblowers were telling the truth. But the administration didn't want to hear it because it was counterfactual to what they were trying to achieve, which was basically in the name of equality on paper to have integrate create gender-neutral infantry unit.
And, you know, James, and the guest is James Hassan, Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. You know, James, also, when it comes to, you know, touchy subjects like gay members of the military, who many of whom serve gallantly and honorably, or transsexual, transgender members of the military, which is a little bit more of a controversial issue. Sometimes, James, some of these people, particularly on the left in this country, I don't think, and I'm sure you've encountered this, I don't think sometimes they stop to think not about right or wrong, but about the conditions that are in the military, whether it's in a barrack condition or sleeping in a hole dug out of the ground or being on submarine duty. And sometimes I think there's just a cavalier attitude of, well, you know, just do it, without having to plug themselves into that scenario where, you know, men and women being men and women, things happen. To me, it's just, it's not studied close enough.
Right. And so I think it's important to distinguish, don't ask, don't tell, which I think was a misguided policy, and it was overruled by Congress, from the transgender policy. Because, don't ask, don't tell, and because the distinguishing characteristic between the military's, the transgender policy that the Trump administration put in place and don't ask, don't tell, is that one is based on, requiring you to comply with biological standards, physical realities, whereas don't ask, don't tell was based on this premise that somebody's outside life has some kind of effect on the unit's performance. And when you dial it down, what really matters in the military is whether or not you can accomplish your goal. Mm-hmm. But under the Obama administration's transgender policy, you had basically soldiers were judged under the physical composition standards and the physical readiness standards of the gender they identified with rather than that of their biological sex. And the way that that comes into play is that the military has different body composition standards and physical fitness standards for men and women. And if you have a 21 or an 18-year-old female soldier with 21% body fat, mm-hmm. she's considered fit for duty. But if you had an 18-year-old male soldier with 21% body fat, that soldier is considered a liability and is non-deployable.
Interesting.
But under the policy that the Obama administration had put in place, you could be a biologically male, 18-year-old soldier, but identify as female, and have 21% body fat, and be deployable when you otherwise wouldn't be, according to your physiology.
And again, James, that plays into, right, the readiness of the unit and how that person will or can, operate in a life or death situation. James, sorry, our time is up. The name of the book, folks, is Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. James Hassan is the guest, distinguished military veteran, commentator and expert on all things in the U.S. military. James, good luck with the book. It's selling very well, I see, getting great reviews on Amazon, and hopefully we can talk in the future. James, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Well, there you go, folks. There you go. It sometimes just comes down to strength. Strength. Guys are stronger than women in the field, right? You've got to have some standards. It's different when you're up in a jet plane or operating an attack helicopter versus being in a trench. Even I know that. Short, pudgy, out of shape me.
The only place in Fairfield County for live local talk. This is Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli, WICC 600.
And we head for our weekly Capitol update with Stratford's own Republican State Senator Kevin Kelly joins us right now at WICC 600. Kevin, Paul here. How you been?
Hey, pretty good. Yourself?
Not too bad. Getting along. Kevin, you and Len Fasano and George Logan issued an op-ed piece. And I want you to talk about that because it's interesting. I had a couple of calls earlier this week from a couple of guys who asked me the same thing. What is the deal going on with some of this Medicaid funding in Connecticut, and they obviously were talking about something that they had heard regarding nursing homes and such that I know you and Len and George of all and the entire caucus there has been concerned about.
Absolutely, Paul. I mean, what this demonstrates and what I'm going to say Connecticut Republicans are trying to get across here is that the Democrats have placed politics before people and, quite frankly, are taking human out of human services. It may not seem like a big number, $5 million in the budget, but what they're doing is cutting an already discounted Medicaid rate to nursing homes. And that's going to affect people here in the greater Bridgeport area, those that utilize Carleton and Fairfield or Hewitt and Shelton. And those facilities are going to get less Medicaid dollars to help what quite frankly, are critically ill individuals. And it's going to force one of a couple of things. One, it's going to force these nursing homes to think long and hard about accepting individuals with chronic conditions, thereby denying access to people who truly need it.
Mm-hmm.
And two, could force closure of these nursing homes that not only denies access to care, but also we lose valuable jobs in the local economy. And the thing is that these budgetary issues, a $5 million cut here, is done because the Democrats have other priorities. Priorities like giving state employees $91 million with a 7% pay raise.
Must be nice. Must be nice.
Must be nice. There's another fringe benefits to UConn Health Center and to the state college system where one is getting an additional $33 million, another's getting $28 million. So these are choices that the choice could have been to give critically ill seniors the care that they deserve or to give government itself an extra raise.
Kevin,
and the Democrats have chosen the raise.
You also point out in this piece that one of the things that the Democratic majority, you say, voted no against was $1 million cutout here, which would have allowed seniors to do what when it comes to personal care products and items?
Yeah, this is, I'm going to say, the most unkindest cut. Because what we're talking about is somebody who has gone through their life savings, their entire retirement, lost their home, given up all their income except for $60. And the last $60 is used for things like toiletries, toothpaste, soap.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to increase that to put it back to where it was when Governor Rell was in office, up to from $60 to $69, and the Democrats said, no, we're not going to give the greatest generation, an individual who has done everything right,
mm-hmm.
now is on Medicaid, the ability to buy, you know, a haircut or, you know, toothpaste. And I think that that's just taking dignity away from our seniors.
And I remember, Kevin, when both my mom and dad were in nursing homes toward the latter part of their lives, that, you know, there was the business managers in the nursing homes who would tell me in each facility, you know, make sure that, you know, we pull out the money for, you know, their care needs, Kevin. Like you said, a haircut at the beauty salon where my mom was, or, mm-hmm. you know, something to be done with my father, personal needs like that, even if it was something like, you know, a newspaper. Paper or soap or aftershave or stuff like that, yeah.
And it's only $1 million, and they couldn't find it in their heart to do that. Another issue here is also the reinsurance program. We hear, you know, all the time about how Democrats want to help health care, and they had an opportunity staring right in their face where we could have given Connecticut families up to a 20% relief discount on their health care premiums,
mm-hmm.
with a reinsurance program. And the Democrats couldn't find it in the budget and didn't move forward. But yet, on the low end of that, at least a 5% increase would have been $19 million. But on the other hand, they found that million in the drop of a hat, and the governor donned a tie and went up to stores to allow UConn to join the Big East. So
yeah.
When they want to find money,
oh, it's there. It's there.
But when the priorities that I think are really, I'm going to say, basic human rights,
mm-hmm.
health care, dignity for seniors, the Democrats don't have the appetite.
Hey, Kevin, final thing before we let you go. One of your compadres there on the other side of the aisle, Will Haskell from the Senate, said the other day at a forum, you probably saw this in Lower Fairfield County, he said he alluded to yet another toll plan that we might see in the fall before we turn the calendar year and get into an election year. Anything you're hearing concrete on that or not?
I haven't heard anything concrete on that, you know, and obviously the devil is always in the details. But as a state senator coming from Stratford, which is the location that caused the, the removal of the tolls across the state, I really am going to look hard at those because I'm going to be reticent before the government's going to put their hand in our pockets again. The one big issue here that is really difficult to get over is that Connecticut taxpayers, through the one of the highest gas tax in the nation, have already made the sacrifice for our roads, bridges, and rail.
I mean, people call and ask me, Kevin, where is that money going? They ask constantly, you know, where is the gas tax money going?
It gets swept and spent through the general fund. And that's what I would be afraid of here once again, is that we're going to make yet another sacrifice for the same purpose, one that's already been done, and it'll get intercepted and spent elsewhere. Despite the fact we have a lockbox, the money has to get from our pocket to the lockbox first, but it can get intercepted by the General Assembly. And that's my fear, is that it'll get intercepted and spent somewhere else, and we'll still have poor roads, poor bridges, and a slow rail.
The fantasy lockbox. Kevin, thank you. Enjoy the holiday weekend, and we'll speak next week.
Hey, you do likewise, Paul.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin Kelly, Republican State Senator from Stratford. Yeah, they intercepted folks. Listen, we're not kidding. When Democrats in Hartford are asked on the record, well, why doesn't this money end up in the transportation lockbox? They say, well, we don't take it out, we intercept it. That's what they say. It's like throwing that 5-yard screen that gets intercepted because you didn't get behind it. Yeah.